Hey there, fellow entrepreneurs. If you're tired of complicated domain management, I've got the solution for you, Hover.com. Hover makes registering and managing domains a breeze. Their clean interface and hassle-free experience will save you time and frustration. No upsells, no hidden fees, just straightforward domain services. Plus, Hover offers top-notch customer support. Make your life easier. Head over to foxcitiesmm.com/hover and simplify your domain journey today.
You're listening to Fox City's Murder and Mayhem, your bi-weekly dose of true crime history in a small rural community of Wisconsin.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Fox City's Murder and Mayhem. I'm Eric.
I'm Gavin.
And Gavin, we're back.
Yep.
We're traveling to where?
We're in Neenah this time.
We're in Neenah. Cool.
Yeah.
I don't think we've had a ton of Neenah stories.
You might have done one.
We did. Neenah? We did the coffee house that burned down. That was Neenah, right? Or was that Oshkosh?
Oh, no. That's Oshkosh.
That was Oshkosh?
Yeah. Okay. No.
Maybe we haven't even done a Neenah. We must have done a Neenah.
I think we've done a Neenah, but it's not one that comes up a lot. Yeah. But here it is. Originally, when I put this together, I thought, oh, I'm going to do half of this is like crime and half of this is like the history of a building.
Mm-hmm.
In the history of the building, like...
when you looked into the history, you're like, yeah, there's no history here.
Well, there is, but it didn't really pull through. So it'll come up, but you'll be like, why did you even bother? So I say that to explain the opening here. We're going to be talking about the building that was at 311 North Commercial Street in Neenah, which is no longer there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you said was there, so yeah. Obviously, is there something else there now, or is it just a lot?
Well, there's probably something else there, but that building is not there.
Okay.
It was built in 1888. It was traditionally known as Charles Herziger's Saloon. So that was the name that like it was in like the records, that's what people called it. So that's what we're talking about. Not a whole lot seemed to happen in that building. So that was fine.
So you're like, so that's the end of the episode.
That's the end of the episode. In 1940, the building and tavern were purchased by William Paul, age 39, who would operate it for over 30 years.
Wow.
And William Paul is the focus of our story today. And we'll get right into it. On the morning of August 6, 1973, William Paul, who at this point is now 72 years old, made a deposit at the First National Bank around 8:30 a.m. and then continued to his place of business. There, he was robbed by three men and beaten at his tavern, the Midway Bar. Later reports suggest that between $300 and $500 was taken. Around 10 a.m., a man entered the tavern and found a pool of blood. He called police, who arrived and transported Paul to Theta Clark, where he was in critical condition and underwent surgery for hours. The caller did not identify himself, so we don't know who showed up, saw this, and made the call. I'm not sure that they ever figured out who showed up and made the call.
So they showed up, made the call, and then just got the hell out of there, basically?
It seems to be.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, at least they made the call, right?
Yeah. The first two people we know on the scene besides the caller were Connie Murphy and Leroy Cole, both of Neenah, but it doesn't seem that either one of them was the caller.
Okay.
Sergeant Rupert Lehman said that when Paul was found, he was still conscious but incoherent. They tried to ask him things and he was completely delirious. I'm going to throw in a side note here, and this has nothing to do with anything, but this is just me being me, all right?
Okay.
Throughout the coverage of this story, the newspaper repeatedly referred to William Paul as elderly. And this was weird to me. Now, don't get me wrong. He's 72 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, What? How do we define elderly? You know,
past retirement age.
Yeah, like I mean, like I wasn't sure because, like, yeah, like okay, he's a senior, he's getting the discount on coffee. Yeah, okay, but I'm like, to me, elderly is kind of like you reach the point in life where you're no longer really actively doing a whole lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and this guy's still running his
bar, and. So, like, this is nothing, like I said, nothing to do with the story, but it jumps out at me because, like, once you refer to somebody as elderly, to me, like, in my brain, that's like, oh, you're in a nursing home,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, you're kind of, you're on your last stretch of life. No disrespect to the elderly, but that's, but that's what that word implies to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, even though this guy is 72, which is, you know, he's lived a decent life, I wouldn't call him elderly.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Feel free to email me and say how the word elderly reads to you, because to me, like, it doesn't – it maybe this is different because this is, you know, the 70s compared to today. But today when I read it, elderly doesn't even sound like a nice thing to call somebody. It sounds like an automatic negative label to put on a person.
And I would agree with you. Like, I think you wouldn't see them use that in – this is one of those things that – this is for that time. That's how they wrote these things.
Yeah.
But it probably isn't really acceptable to today. Not so much. I don't know if like people are like get all offended by it or anything, but you just don't say that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not an offensive word, but it's just like, it's like, I can't imagine what the point of using it was other than like to get people to be sympathetic.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you beat up a man. That's bad. You beat up an elderly man. That's worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So totally. Maybe that was the point. I don't know. A small office in the back of the tavern was used by Paul to repair clocks, a hobby that he had done every day for 30 years. The room had blood spattered on the walls and the ceiling. A safe containing money was in the room, but was not open. There was also still money in the cash register. George Paul, the son of William Paul, said it was common for his dad to have money in his pants pocket and wallet, both of which were now empty when the police arrived. So apparently the people showed up to rob him, didn't even bother with the register or save, just took whatever money he had on him and left. Police used metal detectors to search the area for the weapon. Based on the injuries, they knew that it was a blunt object, but beyond that, they didn't know what it was. Even nearby rooftops were searched in case they had thrown the weapon up on a roof.
Wow.
Sure. I mean, could happen.
Yeah, it's a very common, probably, way that they ditch a...
Yeah. William Paul remained in the hospital for 16 days.
Holy crap.
Before finally dying on the 16th day at 1:15 in the morning on August 22nd. Coroner Dwayne Moore said the cause of death was excessive brain damage. So I think that's probably a given. Paul was survived by his widow, Josephine, two daughters, and three sons, including Mrs. Judith Murphy and James Paul of Nina. He's buried in Oak Hill Cemetery. On the day of Paul's death, Sergeant Lee Parrott said they had a suspect in Anago, and he would be going that day to interview him. He told the press, "I think whoever did this was a madman, and we think that Paul faced them instead of giving in," which seems consistent with the beating. Typically, when you are a robber, your intention is not to severely beat and kill a person.
You just want the
money.
Yeah.
So I think that's reasonable that Paul fought back and the robber wasn't cool with that.
Mm-hmm.
A month later, an informant said the weapon used was a wooden ice cube breaker. Another source said that prior to the beating, one of the robbers went berserk and threw a stool at Paul, knocking him to the floor. Now, I don't know who these sources are. I don't know how they would know what the weapon was. I don't know how they would know what happened during the fight. No idea. So I can't gauge the reliability of that.
And I think it's kind of weird to, like, I get having an informant on, like, mafia type things.
Yeah.
But an informant on just what seems to be a random robbery seems a little strange.
You don't think police have informants?
Well, I think they have informants, but I think the informants feel like an informant for like drug dealing. That makes sense to me because it's the same people drug dealing all the time. But having an informant for somebody that does random robberies seems a little strange to me.
I don't think it's specifically for that. I think my impression here is that the informant is basically somebody who hangs out at like the bars. And then they pass on information they hear at the bars.
Okay.
To their friend in the police department. Because people in bars sometimes talk about things they probably shouldn't talk about.
Especially when you get a couple of those drinks in them.
Yeah. But you're not going to do that if you know a cop is sitting next to you.
But if just
some So I think in this, and I don't know this, but I'm thinking like what this is basically the informant is a guy who's passing on rumors he heard in the bars. Mm-hmm. I think that's all it is. I don't think it's like this guy is specifically the guy they go to being like, hey, can you see what you can find on beatings and robberies? Like, I don't think that's for that purpose.
When you describe that, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So
I don't know that, but I'm guessing that's how this would work.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that year, Sergeant Parrott showed the press his file. It had grown to be 2 inches thick already. He said he was working on it constantly. This has kind of gotten to be an obsession, he explained. It's a major investigation. I just put things aside when anything comes up on this. Parrott said he grew up on Doty Island and had known William Paul since he was a kid. Since Parrott was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So far, Parrott had interviewed 80 people and traveled to Milwaukee, Waupun, and other places. He was confident the case would be solved. He just didn't know when. The newspaper pointed out that homicide was extremely rare in Neenah. The last one, this is 1973, the last one was in 1952, and the one before that was in 1908.
Wow. That's why we don't have a lot of stories for Neenah.
I also don't think this is accurate. I think this is not correct because I don't remember the exact year. I want to say it's 1963, but there was a guy killed. When we did this story, there was a guy killed at a gas station. And I think like they're like, oh, well, that didn't happen in Neenah because it was off the highway outside of city limits.
village of Menasha or something?
Yeah, so it was probably tackled by the county sheriff and not by the Neenah Police Department. So on a technicality, yes, it wasn't in Neenah. But I think you would still refer to that as a Neenah gas station.
Yeah.
So I think this makes it sound – but either way, from the police department's point of view, they haven't had to solve a murder in over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 20 years, you know. So it is unusual for them. Things kind of go quiet after that. On January 29th, 1975, so this is now about a year and a half later, a John Doe probe was launched by Judge William Crane investigating armed robbery in Winnebago County. Since July 1973, there had been 16 armed robberies in Winnebago, with many similarities between them. A parade of witnesses from Neenah, Menasha, and Oshkosh testified in secret. Based on who was coming and going, the newspapers soon realized that part of the investigation, if not the main point of the investigation, was the William Paul murder. On the first day, 10 people testified, and by day two, Crane confirmed that the robbery was part of the investigation. Officially, this was to try to get these armed robberies solved and see the connection between them. But of course, one of the armed robberies also involved a murder. So that one was sort of top of the pile there.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention at this point, for the people who listen to the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, we talk about John Doe probes sometimes. Mm-hmm. Don't know that it's really much come up on
Fox City. That's a good point, yeah, actually.
Don't know it's really come up on Fox City's Murder and Mayhem. John Doe probe is a weird thing that's a Wisconsin thing. I'm pretty sure Wisconsin's the only state that has it. It's kind of like a grand jury where a judge or other official calls a series of hearings on a specific topic, and people come in, they testify. It's all secret. It never comes out. Sometimes if things go to trial, like part of the testimony might come out to be used in trial, but otherwise it remains secret. 50 years, 100 years can pass. You'll never see what people talked about there. And at the end of this, the judge, prosecutors, whatever, go through it and they see if they can come up with something to start charging people with what they're looking into. So when we do Milwaukee Mafia, usually what they're looking into is gambling. Here, it's specifically armed robbery. But for people who aren't familiar with what a John Doe probe is, that's what it is. It's just a kind of a secret hearing where people testify on specific topics which as opposed to like a normal, generally speaking, when you get people to testify, it's like to target a specific person to charge them with it. Here, there's no specific person. It's kind of figured out if there will be a person to target. So it's a weird system because you're basically investigating a crime with no known person to charge anything with.
And I feel it's imperative to point out too that.
Yeah.
Because this is something that was used back in the day quite regularly, but it is by no means gone today.
It is not gone.
It doesn't happen nearly as often today, but they still do use this in the state of Wisconsin.
They do still use it in the state of Wisconsin,
which is just mind blowing to me because I feel like this made sense probably 60 years ago, maybe, but today there's just way better technologies and stuff than a bunch of hearsay. But I guess it still gets you.
It's not technically hearsay because they are under oath. So it's like they're not just telling you random rumors they heard. They're calling in people who should know something about something.
Yeah, I suppose. It's just a really
weird
system.
Even though it's secret, you can be charged with perjury if you lie. So there is some kind of checks and balances to it.
We talked about on one of our Mafia episodes about how there's just weird things that that happen, and we talked about the weird alcohol laws on our last Patreon episode that Gavin is going to research and figure out why these weird laws.
Yeah.
This would be another
We're just advertising every podcast this episode. Yeah.
With this one, this would be another one of the things I would like to... Where it came from and why is it only in Wisconsin?
We could do that.
Yeah, because that's really an interesting thing to me, too.
That'd probably end up on the Patreon as well, but we could do that.
Yeah, because I think that would be a very interesting thing to learn about. So.
Okay. Yeah. Offhand, I don't know. I'm sure I've read it in the past, but I don't remember. So, yeah, we could do that.
So, but nothing ever comes of this? Or we still got more notes?
There's still a little more notes.
Okay.
Still a little more notes.
Let's finish the story before I ask any more questions.
Okay. So even though this is supposed to be secret, reporters were lurking outside the courthouse, seeing who was coming in and out of the building that day. They didn't hear any of the testimony, but they were able to identify some of the people coming and going. They found Thomas Jury, age 23, Darwin Moore, age 26, Bruce Johnson, age 25, his wife Judy Johnson, Stanley Samuel, age 26, and Patricia Allen. Patricia Allen was the girlfriend of Leroy Chapin, age 24, who was currently on trial for robbing an Oshkosh pharmacy. Chapin himself was not at the John Doe, and I'm guessing this is probably because he was currently on trial. I don't know exactly how this would play out, but it seems like that would be like a Fifth Amendment violation to ask people about armed robberies while they're on trial for armed robbery, because he'd then have to like talk about the crimes he's actively involved in. So I don't know. I'm not sure exactly why he wasn't there, but I'm guessing it's something to do with that. The men they were able to identify were known criminals, not major criminals, but known criminals. A couple of them were actually still behind bars at the time and were brought out of prison to testify. Because Winnebago had seen numerous onset armed robberies in the last 2 years, they were hoping that, you know, if these guys could help solve one of them, it would solve others. I don't know that it helped solve any of them, but they were able to get these guys on the record about what they knew about different people who were in armed robbery gangs. Don't know what they said because it's a John Doe probe, but they got guys who they knew to be armed robbers to talk about it. And then this is 1975, fades away again. In 1981, jumping back to the original thing that I wanted to do, but we didn't get to do because I didn't find anything. 1981, the tavern was surveyed for possible inclusion as a state historic landmark.
Really?
Yes. Or as part of a historic business district. Although the Wisconsin Historical Society does maintain a file on the property, it does not appear that it was ever declared a landmark. When the city of Neenah did their own survey in 2004, because Neenah has its own landmarks commission that they can declare local things of historic relevance. When they looked in 2004, the building had been demolished. Not that there would have been any evidence from the murder there, you know, in 2004, you know, 30 years later, but this effectively removed any known site connected with the crime. So now there's nothing remaining today that if you were one of those weird people that likes to visit crime scenes, sorry, you can't. And if the building was ever going to be considered historic, well, it didn't happen because they tore it down. Around February 1991, over 17 years after the crime, authorities announced that they had taken hair and blood samples from a suspect, a 40-year-old man in Waupun State Prison. Both blood and hair were found at the crime scene that did not match Paul's blood and hair. Paul had type O blood, but the blood found was type B. This new lead came to light when an informant told Neenah Police Captain Lee Parrott the two men told him the day before the robbery and murder what they had planned to do. He had overheard them talking in the Doty Tavern. The alleged suspect's girlfriend also told police that he had made comments suggesting he was involved. Court filings for this search warrant to get the blood and the hair show that some of this was already known by police as early as 1976 without much action. I don't know why they knew some of this in 76 but didn't do a search warrant until 1991. I'm guessing here that maybe they had like a high level of probable cause they had to meet to get a judge to sign off on it. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. It does seem really weird. The newspaper thought it was really weird. Mm-hmm. I also think it's really weird.
But you said this wasn't the guy, right? Because the blood type was different, right?
The blood type was different from the victim, which is how they determined that the killer also apparently left some blood there.
Okay.
Either way, whatever the case may be, the district attorney declined to identify the suspect, but said, "We feel there's still a realistic prospect of bringing Mr. Paul's killer to justice." This is 1991.
Okay.
And then nobody was arrested.
No, so, we go quiet again, right?
So apparently whoever's blood and hair they took, I guess I can't say they're not the guy, but it wasn't conclusive enough that they could do anything about it. That's 1991.
So it's going to come up again, huh?
In 2022.
Wow.
Neenah Police reviewed the case once more. At this point, it's under the watch of Investigative Sergeant Jeremy Bauman. He said, "Some interviews have been conducted, but there's really no new developments." So as of this recording in early 2024, the case is now 50 years old. It remains unsolved. And I mean, and there's been some time. I mean, it's 50 years is some time. The original investigator, Lee Parrott, he's dead. He's gone. So hopefully he took good notes because he's not even around anymore. So, yeah, this is a cold one.
Yeah.
As so many of them are. But It's interesting. The guys who testified at the John Doe were all in their 20s. So you do the math on that. That means they're now in their 70s. Mm-hmm. I'm not implying that any of those guys was the killer or involved in that robbery. So be very clear. I'm not implying that any of those guys that I named are killers.
But the thought process being is that if they were bringing in 20-year-olds to talk about them, yeah. more than likely our culprit is around that age range.
Right.
So.
Exactly. Thank you. I was like, that's you're following me really good. you're like ready to go with my next point. The whole thing, yeah, that I'm getting at is that if the killer was in their 20s at the time, even though 50 years have passed, the killer would only be in their 70s today.
And it's fully reasonable that they're still alive.
Right.
And around.
So this is a cold case, but it's not a done case. Like, you can't throw it out quite yet because there could be a 70-year-old guy, wonderful grandfather, loves his kids, you know, who also killed a guy.
You know what? What I think is really interesting about one of the points you talked about, they went back and reviewed this case in 2022,
mm-hmm.
which at that point, like you said, it's like, what, 48 years old at that point?
Yeah.
And it just shocks me that they actually go back and review a case that old. Because, I mean, what are you going to find, right? In a way?
Yeah. I mean, there's things you could do. There's things you could do. So in 1991, they've got the hair and the blood, right? And in 1991, I'm not sure how well DNA was understood. I know it was, so using the O.J. Simpson trial as my benchmark, I know it was understood by 94, 95. But 91, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So if they still have this blood, they could, in theory, now run a DNA test on it and actually identify whose blood it is. Now, the question is, in 1991, did they maintain that blood?
Right.
Or did somebody lose it? Did they run so many tests on it that there's almost nothing left?
I would assume that it's gone because all they mentioned in there is that they interviewed some other people, right?
Yeah.
And don't you think if they revisited and they still had the blood, the first thing they would have talked about was running the DNA? I mean, that's the go-to because that's going to be the easiest way to.
That's what I would do.
Yeah,
because at this point, if you don't have the blood, the only way this case is getting solved is basically if you get a guy to admit to it.
Yeah. The reason I say that it's so interesting they revisit it, I would love to know, like, what does that mean? Does that mean?
I assume that means the guy spent his 8-hour shift reading the file. Like, I don't think that they probably did a whole lot more with it.
Yeah, like, just what does that mean going into it? Like, does that just mean that, hey, they slap it on the captain's desk and say, hey, we need, like, an update on this, and the captain just writes something up, signs it, and it gets published? Or is there more, you know, like, what really does that mean? Because I mean, I got to imagine if they're doing this with every case, most of them are going to be completely dead in the water.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I am not a police officer, but I have requested many murder files, including ones that remain unsolved. And I can tell you that there's a steady decline. The first couple of days, piles of paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks, paperwork. Months, paperwork. After the end of that first year, you might occasionally see another page or two get added. But yeah, at the 50-year mark, no.
Nothing.
No, there's not going to be anything in there. Like, the most that's going to happen is maybe a note being like, we made a phone call to victim's daughter, asked her if she'd heard anything. She said no. Like, that's all you're going to get. They're not actively going out there and re-questioning, like, 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
After the first couple of years, there's really, unless somebody comes with a tip, they're not doing much of anything.
Yeah. And I just wonder, like, if a review, like, do they have to put something in there every so often just because it's an open case? Is that just the rules? So maybe they call a couple people
and say,
have you heard anything new about this? Anything that really gives us anything to go on? And then they file that and they say, okay, it's good for another 10 years or whatever it is. You know, it's just kind of an interesting
It might be a newspaper thing. Because, like, my experience is primarily with you know, stuff from Milwaukee or bigger cities.
Mm.
And I get that in that case. Like, if Milwaukee detectives aren't going to solve a case in the first 6 months to a year, they don't have the time to actively go back over it. Like, it's not necessarily that they don't care or they don't have leads. Sometimes it's just they don't have time.
Time, right.
Because more people are dying. In cities like Neenah, like, there might – so what I said about what a file looks like, that might actually be slightly different in Neenah because you're going to have that.
Right.
You're going to have – if they have like a 10-year period until the next murder happens, you might spend more time going back to it. But either way, I don't think at the 50-year mark you're doing anything. I don't see that. What probably happens is every couple – like every 5 years, like the Post-Crescent – runs a series of articles on unsolved murders in the Fox Cities, and they call up the police departments. Somebody pulls the file, looks at it. I'm thinking that's largely what it is.
And then they just basically say, okay, we looked at it, so they just put – they have to put that in the file or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm not saying – like, I don't mean that to sound like I'm talking crap about the detectives. I have huge respect for the detectives. It's just, what are you going to do?
Right. I mean – it happened 50 years ago. Yeah. It's going to be hard to really, at this point, be able to uncover anything new.
You know,
because, I mean, in a lot of situations, a lot of the people that were, I mean, sure, there's plenty of people that are around still from that era that remember that event.
But, oh, yeah.
But, I mean, like,
if you were in your 20s and you hung out at the bars, you knew this.
But, really, most of those people are not going to know anything.
Right.
They might just be able to tell you, oh, I remember when that happened, you know, or something.
Right.
So, but interesting story and good that we got over to Neenah for once.
Yeah, we got over to Neenah.
So, do you got anything else on this
one? Or should we wrap this episode up? That's the end of it. I couldn't tell you what our next one is. I got a couple options, so we'll see which one I actually pick. But
so. But like you say, he's got a long list of episodes, so we're not
going
to have to run reruns for quite some time, it sounds like. So.
I don't even know how many I have. It's at least like 8. So it's going well.
Yeah. Awesome. So, all right. Well, with that, we want to thank everybody for their continued support of this podcast. We will be back in 2 weeks with another episode, and we will see y'all then. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Fox City's Murder and Mayhem. Join us in 2 weeks for another exciting episode of Murder and Mayhem.